It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Lars. Together, we can forge a new beginning for America.
The 45th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And yes, together, we will make America great again. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless America.
Now, honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
And although the law required no reason at all to fire an FBI director, the administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI by saying that the organization was in disarray, that it was poorly led, that the workforce had lost confidence in its leader. Those were lies. Plain and simple.
No, I don't think that they were. In fact, over the last year, I've interviewed so many former FBI agents, so many folks who used to work, well, for example, one, Ron Hosko, who you'll hear from later on. Ron Hosko talked about the fact that the agency was having problems because James Comey, the man whose voice you just heard a moment ago, was not running the agency in a way that made the agency proud. And I could give you specific examples. The very fact that he would come out having done an investigation of Hillary Clinton and say, she did all these things, but we're not going to prosecute her, and that no reasonable person would bring charges against her, that was clearly not a proud moment for the FBI. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Thursday night, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. The Navy is working on a new way to fight, and it involves one of the largest aerospace companies in the nation. Are the spending habits of millennials today starving certain industries, or are they simply not interested in the same businesses and choices that their parents once made? And I'll give you details of how we're going to keep on top of the nation's armed forces. Oh, and by the way, please cast a vote in my quick poll at LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by AMAC, the Association of Mature American Citizens. Conservative values is what it's all about. Just go to amac.us to join or call 888-262-2006. AMAC is better for you and better for America. Our question tonight: does James Comey's testimony help or hurt Donald Trump? I'll tell you what, I think it helps Donald Trump a lot because it clears up a lot of questions that Americans have had for some long time. In yesterday's quick poll, should a president demand loyalty from those who work for him? The answer, 88% of you said yes, and just 12% of you said no. By the way, while you're at the website, visit my trophy room at LarsLarson.com. Post a picture and a paragraph about your latest hunting or fishing adventure for a chance to win some fantastic prizes. If you'd like to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every night at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. So here's what we know today after fired FBI Director James Comey gave his testimony to Congress. This is my take. A year ago, Comey was doing a criminal investigation of Hillary Clinton, but he was ordered by Attorney General Loretta Lynch not to call it a criminal investigation. She instructed him to only call it a matter, which is an obfuscation, a fancy word for a lie. Comey went along with the deception in a move that clearly aided the woman who was then seeking the Democrat Party nomination for president. Comey then held a news conference to clear Hillary Clinton of any prosecution, despite the crime she committed and despite the fact that James Comey didn't have the authority to clear her of prosecution. Earlier this year, Comey told the Congress that he distrusted President Donald Trump enough that Comey took notes about conversations with the president. Trump asked him to make it clear to Americans that the president was not under investigation. Comey did not tell Americans Trump was not under investigation until it was leaked not long ago. That sure stinks like partisanship to me. When the president fired him, Comey used a law professor friend to secretly leak a memo to the New York Times that was damaging to the president. Comey admits that the president did not order him to drop the investigation of Michael Flynn. Comey admits the president did not commit obstruction of justice. Comey says the president lied about him. Well, consider the source if you believe that. Comey admits the president was never under investigation for alleged links to Russia, and that admission today before the Congress, before the Senate committee that he was testifying to, is enough to clear up a lot of misunderstandings out there. To your calls now at 866-439-5277. Let's go to Russell first. Hey, Russell, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. Hey, Russell. All right, let's go to Richard in California. Hey, Richard, welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, pleasure to listen to you every day.
Actually, thank you.
Very recent listener, and I really enjoyed it. Hey, you know, I read an article online, not sure which one of them there is. There's a lot of them, but now it's not collusion, which isn't a crime, but now it's obstruction. And my question is, why would a guy that literally has the people's power to pardon anybody collude to obstruct justice on him?
There's no reason. I mean, here's what they're trying to say, and they're kind of caught in a box, because if Donald Trump engaged in obstruction of justice, if that had been the case, the first thing that James Comey was supposed to do was immediately notify the attorney general or the deputy attorney general that the president was trying to obstruct justice. I mean, let's say that the president had called in James Comey, then when he was head of the FBI, and said, "You've found some evidence of Russian collusion in our elections. I want you to destroy that evidence." That would be a clear case where the president was trying to obstruct justice. I don't think there'd be any question about it. The first thing Comey should have done was go to his boss, the attorney general, and say, "The president is attempting to obstruct justice. I want you to act on it. And if you don't act on it, I'm going to submit my resignation, and I'm going to go public with the allegation." Comey didn't do that. And he admits that when he met with the president talked to him about the Flynn investigation, which appears to be about nothing at all at this point, that he didn't see the president obstructing justice. And that's what a lot of the questions to James Comey were about today. He admits there was no evidence of obstruction of justice. But as long as they keep, and when I say they, the mainstream media, ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, and all the rest, as long as they keep talking about was it obstruction of justice, they can keep connecting Donald Trump's name to something that is negative, and that serves their purposes. So I think that James Comey was in a box because he couldn't very well say, "Well, I saw the president attempt to obstruct justice, but I didn't act on it when I could have as head of the FBI." Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. And I think the same way, obviously. You know, another thing is it would be interesting what would have happened if Donald Trump didn't say, "I have tapes of this." It might have been a little bit different memos that were brought out today.
You know, you raised the same thought that I had, and I mentioned it last hour. But Donald Trump didn't say, "I have tapes of it." And you have to listen carefully, because this isn't trying to find a nuance. Donald Trump said, "Well, if that's what you're going to say, you better hope there aren't tapes," right?
But that sure would change someone's testimony in front of Congress if there's possibly tapes.
Yeah, it would. It would, because I wonder whether James Comey went back home and rewrote the memo, because he might have written it one way, and then if he thought the president has tapes of this, because ordinarily I don't have a problem with tapes of conversations, and I'll tell you why. The only person that is hurt by a tape of a conversation is the person who lied about the conversation. You know that? It's one reason why when you call the airlines or a hotel and you make a reservation and they say some phone calls are taped for quality assurance, they're telling you, if one of our associates says, "Oh, yeah, we got plenty of rooms, come on down," and then they don't, well, they're going to get caught out by that. And that only works against the liar, the person who doesn't tell the truth. I appreciate the call. Thanks a lot, Richard. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Honestly provocative talk. at LarsLarsen.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larsen Show. Glad to be with you. We've spent a lot of today talking about dysfunction in the federal government, but there is one part of the federal government that is exceedingly important, and that is the United States military. So I thought I'd bring on Tim Kaine, who is a specialist in immigration studies at the Hoover Institution down at Stanford University, and the author most recently of Total Volunteer Force, Returning Autonomy to Our Armed Forces. Good to have you back, Tim.
Lars, great to talk to you.
And congratulations on the book. So we'll put Comey and all the rest of this nonsense I've been talking about today to the side. How do we make sure that the all-important military serves our country well and is at the peak of its abilities?
Yeah, well, you know, Lars, I served for a few years as an Air Force officer, and I remember just loving and admiring the people, the men and women I served with, and still do. So I've done some research over the years on the quality of the troops, which are just extraordinary. But the bureaucracy, because it is a government organization, bureaucracy, as a lot of your listeners can tell you, is just as bad, if not worse, in the services. So what I wanted to do with this book was, one, pay homage to the all-volunteer force. I think having that instead of a draft is great. It's all about liberty. It's what we should do. But we still have a coercion-based system for every day after the first day that you volunteer. So why don't we make it a total volunteer force? And that was really the point of the book. And it's been based on research I've done talking to not only sailors and soldiers, but on commanders and what they think.
So how do you get that change to come about? And what's it going to take?
You know, the funny thing is we've had two secretaries of defense, Ash Carter and Robert Gates, who've said this is their number one worry. So it's not like we don't have the attention of top leaders in the Pentagon. Of course, my ex-colleague Jim Mattis is now the Secretary of Defense. But we really need to get Congress to wake up and realize that this system, this bureaucracy that they have mandated, the Army has to look like the Navy and the Air Force, they need to change some laws to give the service chiefs more flexibility.
Are the folks at the very top in favor, though, of doing that, or is there a power question tied up in this as well?
I don't think, you know, it'd be nice to think if Dr. Evil was out there, if there was some intellectual opponent saying, no, we need a giant government bureaucracy. It's not that, Lars. It's just bureaucratic momentum. A lot of people say, hey, we've always done it this way. Well, that's not true. Believe me, Patton had a lot more flexibility than our modern generals do. And the other pushback I get is, well, we don't want to look like Google and Microsoft. And I get that. We don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. That's why this book celebrates the leadership culture, but using really interesting survey results points out the talent management rules are what's broken. So it's just trying to break the bureaucratic momentum, I think, spreading awareness, and appreciate you helping with that.
I'm talking to Tim Kaine, who's the author most recently of Total Volunteer Force, Returning Autonomy to Our Armed Forces. So when you talk about autonomy, how do you reframe it so that you still have a command structure? Commander-in-Chief, Secretary of Defense, Joint Chiefs of Staff, or do you blow up that structure as well?
No, I wouldn't. In fact, you know, this issue of sexual harassment in the military came up a few years ago, and of course some senators said, hey, we need to take authority away from commanders, and we should, you know, give it to, you know, whatever bureaucrats or central. And I thought, guys, wake up, realize you want to give commanders more authority, because right now, Lars, you can have a Navy captain of a Navy destroyer, got 150, 200, 300 people that work for them. They can't hire anybody that works on that ship. They're all assigned from a central authority. And so there's no background check. There's no informal reference of one captain calling another saying, okay, I can hire Bob, or I can hire Gary, or I can hire Steve. Steve may look good on paper, and he's not a criminal, but he's a harasser. If you let the market forces work and let commanders have more control over who gets hired and fired, you'd have a much better system, and you'd weed out those bad
apples. Well, and not only that, but think about, well, I mean, I don't know that much about sports, Tim, because I honestly don't follow sports that closely, but I understand the mechanisms that work. If you're a college and you want to have a great football team, you say, we got to bring the kids in and we got to show them two things, a really great facility, so they'll be impressed when they visit the campus. And secondly, we got to show them the numbers, the metrics, that if you're an aspiring young football player, basketball player, baseball, whatever, that you'll look at the numbers and say, I don't want to play for a loser team. I want to play for a winner team. So that means that the commander in charge of a big ship, a carrier or a sub, he'd have to go out and in effect recruit, but he'd say, I'm going to make my sub the kind of sub that people are going to serve on because it has great numbers, great performance ratings, you know, and the rest of that. And you could literally get some of that competition going to where there would be certain ships that would probably be more popular than others. And yep. that the most successful sailors would say, I want to be on that ship because that ship does its job, it gets its performance ratings, and maybe even gets a little extra R&R because they perform so well.
That's. I mean, these are insights that aren't that sophisticated.
No, they're not.
Adam Smith said a long time ago, central planning doesn't work. If you let these informal processes work, you get those feedback loops that you're talking about, Lars, happen. I've heard some people complain, well, hey, commanders don't have time. That's nonsense. I've talked to battalion and brigade commanders in the Army. I've talked to captains in the Navy. They know if they could have a little bit more control, they could build the kind of teams. And I think your sports analogy here works. You need better information so you're not just recruiting seven quarterbacks on a team. You're recruiting people and giving them the freedom to specialize, which, again, our services right now have a one-size-fits-all mentality. It's mandated by the Congress. And I think we finally got some service chiefs that are hungry for change.
Well, are there some chiefs at the top of the Pentagon, maybe not at the Joint Chiefs level, but sort of the middle management level there, still in the big building, but, you know, but able to do it, who are willing to do a little bit of experimentation and say, you know, for instance, I mean, wouldn't it be a great proof of performance if you took any unit, whether it's the Navy, the Air Force, the Army, or whatever, and said, we're going to let a couple of these units try it, and they get their pick. They can reach out and pick the best people. And when it starts to work out famously, what's going to happen? All the other entities, the other units, the other divisions, the other brigades are going to say, well, how come they get to do it? We want to be able to do that, too. And you'll find the service, you know, the different sections of the service competing for the best talent out there because the commanders will want it. And I would imagine the service members would want it.
Yeah, yeah, that's absolutely right. I think there is some room for flexibility. But let me point out one area of just it's insane when you think about it. There's tremendous inflexibility in compensation that a captain or a captain equivalent in all the services is paid exactly the same. And you get way more money, Lars, out of seniority. So a 4-year captain, a 6-year captain, 8-year captain, every time you make one of those 2-year gates, the pay tables say, well, this person gets X more dollars. You get more money from the seniority in the pay tables than you do from the rank. And one of the things I pointed out is, look, this was introduced back in the 1940s, when a lot of things look very socialist, and we're not paying individuals based on skill. So even if the service chiefs wanted to do that, right now the Pentagon has a one-size-fits-all pay table that says it's all about seniority, it's not about merit, it's not about skill, it's not about specialty. That's just got to change. The services have their hands tied right now.
That's going to make retention tough because if some lieutenant is making more money, but the sergeant who's the guy who's the very skilled guy sitting at a radar on either a surface ship or a submarine, he's got talents and skills that may be worth a lot in the private sector, and he's sitting there thinking, that lieutenant makes more money than me, but if I leave the service, I can go to work for a big tech company and make a whole lot more money. It's got to be tough to hang on to good talent.
Yeah, and luckily, we get great talent to sign up in the military. We're having a hard time retaining it, and it's because we don't reward people for specializing. And in an era that we're going into, the next 50 years at least, cyber war is going to matter just as much as brawn. You can't live like that. You got to pay for the talent that's going to be critical in the next war.
Well, it sounds like a great prescription for improving the military. And if there's anybody to do it, I would hope our current commander-in-chief would understand it because he comes from that side of the aisle. Tim, thank you so much and congratulations. The book is Total Volunteer Force, Returning Autonomy to Our Armed Forces. Its author is Tim Kaine. And thanks for your military service, Tim. I appreciate your time tonight.
Thanks, Lars. Take care.
You bet. Glad to have you on. Coming up, are millennials' spending habits destroying some age-old industries? And do the boomers share the blame for that?
More honestly provocative talk. right now on the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you, and I want to remind you of something. Father's Day is right around the corner. Dads, I know, are super hard to shop for. The challenge is to find Dad a great-looking gift that's both useful and doesn't break your bank. Well, thankfully this year, there are the Harry's Shave Sets. Now, I've been shaving with Harry's for years and years. I started shaving with Harry's because I found them online, and I thought, this is a great shave set at a decent price. They're limited edition Father's Day shave set includes a matte black razor handle, a chrome razor stand, Harry's moisturizing foaming shave gel, and three of Harry's handcrafted blade cartridges, and it comes with a travel cover, too. It comes in a sleek giftable box with the option to add custom engraving for your dad and a personalized card for free. Just go to harrys.com right now and redeem a special offer just for fans of my show. Harry's will give you $5 off your purchase with promo code Lars. That's L-A-R-S. Don't wait. That's H-A-R-R-Y-S.com. Enter code Lars at checkout and get $5 off. Not only get a great shave yourself, but do a real favor for Dad on this Father's Day. On the phone with me right now is Pavlina Asta, who joins us now, millennial pop culture journalist and social commentator. Pavlina, good to have you back on.
Yes, thank you so much for having me back on, Lars. How's it going?
Oh, it's going great. Now, I know that people like me, who are two or three times as old as people like you, are always complaining about young. But I love seeing young, bright people and the changes they bring to society. But you wrote a fascinating piece in which you suggested that the spending patterns of millennials are threatening whole industries in America. What's going on?
Yeah, so this is so interesting. There was a study, and it was basically saying how millennials are, you know, killing all of these industries, like golfing and different, you know, restaurant franchises and stuff. And I was just kind of like, this is crazy, because I don't think millennials are killing these industries. More or less, they're shifting all of these industries just because of, you know, millennials want, you know, something that's fast and easy and cheap and is convenient. And if we don't have to deal with other people, then, you know, that's even better. So online shopping, you know, millennials have a very big presence with, like, online shopping, which is why Amazon has just been taking over so many aspects of, you know, shopping these days. And, yeah, so that's kind of where it's been going, and it was such an interesting article it was such an interesting study that was saying how basically all these millennials are killing these industries, whereas they're definitely, you know, shifting them more than anything else.
I mean, for one, they don't buy napkins. Are we talking cloth or paper or both?
It's so funny. Okay, so I don't know. I feel like millennials, and, you know, I'm more of a Generation Z, which is right after millennials. And it's so funny because I feel like millennials are just really, like, frugal with their money. Like, I don't buy anything unless it's on sale. Like, the second I find, like, a new website, I'm like, I go straight to sales. And I'm like, okay, what can I find here? And then with napkins, I just go to, like, Chipotle or wherever, and I just, like, grab a bunch of napkins. So I bet, you know, napkin companies and stuff, they're probably having a hard time. But yeah, so I thought that was a really funny part of the study.
That may change when you have a baby in your household. Because I have to tell you, Pavlina, I try to get a good night's sleep every night. I work about 12 hours a day. I went home. I had dinner. I was with the family. I played with the grandbaby for a while. And about 10 o'clock last night, my daughter-in-law woke me up, and she said, "Can you help me?" She knocked on the bedroom door, and the baby had exploded. I mean, she had some kind of stomach thing going on, and it was everywhere. And I thought, okay, now I did it mostly with towels. I was getting her cleaned up and all. But I'll tell you what, when you get kids in your household, napkins may become a whole lot more popular around your household once you've got little kids there.
Definitely, and I think that was another thing, because I know one of the industries that they were in the study that they were saying was dying off because of millennials was golfing. And I was like, well, millennials, like, the oldest millennial right now is around 35, and I don't know, I'm 19, so I don't really know when people start having kids, but I still feel like 35 is, like, pretty young. And, you know, even for, like, golfing, that's, like, one of the industries that they were saying that was dying off. And I still feel like that's pretty young, you know, 35, to, like, be golfing all the time. So I feel like it's almost like we kind of have to wait for millennials to grow into the generation, or to, you know, to basically get a little bit older before we can really say what industries are dying off because of them. You know?
Well, see, when I saw that in your piece, it kind of surprised me. I'm not a golfer, but I have a great appreciation for the sport because— People pay for it themselves. It's generally not subsidized. It's healthy. It's exercise. You got nice green spaces. So I appreciate seeing a golf course in my neighborhood, even if I don't golf on it, because it's just pretty to see the landscape and realize this isn't paid for by the taxpayers. It's paid for by willing folks. And you would think millennials are into exercise. They like the environment. They like all that stuff. You'd think it's one of the sports they'd absolutely love, but they're falling away from it.
I know. I think that's so interesting. That's very interesting. I completely agree with you with being able to look at it. I'm from Florida, and like now I live in New York City, which there's no golf courses anywhere. Okay, but living in Florida, I felt like there was a golf course on like every block. So no, I completely agree. But it's interesting how it is kind of dying off with that. But like I said, I think millennials just kind of have to get into like that age group that really enjoys golfing, or maybe when they have more time, you know.
Well, and I'm not saying that change is bad. I actually think change is healthy for a society. You don't want any one industry to say, well, we're going to be here forever, and we don't have to adapt with the time or adopt with the times. So I'm glad to see certain businesses go away and other businesses take their place. I think that's healthy. I mean, I would not want to see a static kind of society that just did the same things generation after generation.
Exactly. It's so good to see, like, progression and everything like that. It was so funny when I was just kind of, like, you know, thinking on the study and everything. I was like, well, you know, like, when we had the horse and buggy compared to the car, well, I bet some of those people didn't always want a horse and buggy. You know what I mean? It's just like that progression and, like, moving forward into, like, the future kind of stuff. And I feel like a lot of people kind of get set in their ways. And a lot of generations, especially before millennials, like to hate on millennials.
No.
So it's easier to do that than to, you know, kind of praise what's happening, I guess.
Well, I just worry about work ethic, because I want to see a good, healthy work, you know, but you've got a great work ethic. You can find her at Pavlina Osta, PavlinaOsta. Pavlina, it's always a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
It's a pleasure to have you on. Let's go to Russ in Virginia. Hey, Russ, welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
How you doing, Lars?
Quite well.
Yes, sir. I was in the Army 8 years, and I voted for Trump, and I want to thank him for guarding our borders. And
thanks for your service.
Thank you, sir. I got a question about what Hillary Clinton says that she didn't know how to properly safeguard classified documents, and she's Secretary of State. You know, and after 2 weeks of basic training, I knew how, as a private, you know. And how could this go on? And then you got the admirals and the generals in charge of the intelligence agencies. And how did they not know that she was using her personal computer to send classified information?
I think they knew and they excused it because they treated her like the elite where they're allowed to break the rules. And as you say, as a private, I would imagine you had to know, because if as one of your jobs as a private was this general says, run these papers from here over to there, from, you know, this division to that division, you had to know that you couldn't leave those papers sitting on the dashboard of your car, right? Because they were secure papers. You had to make them, you know, move in a way that protected them. So how did Hillary Clinton manage to run for president when she didn't know as much as a private in the military like you? I wish I knew, Russ. I think people are believing her excuses, and I think that's all there are is excuses. But thank you very, very much for your service to America, and thanks for the phone call as well. You want a real perspective on what James Comey had to say to the Senate today? Former Assistant Director of the FBI Ron Hosko is joining me next to tell us what he thinks about James Comey's testimony, and he actually knows James Comey. And I'm glad to get your emails, too. Send those. They all come directly to me, talk@LarsLarson.com. Follow me on Twitter @LarsLarsonShow and on Facebook @TheLarsLarsonShow.
Naysayers go to the head of the line on the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can always, well, go to my Facebook page, The Lars Larson Show. Follow on Twitter @LarsLarsonShow. And, of course, it's always wonderful to welcome back to the program Ron Hosko, who is president of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund and former assistant director of the FBI. Ron, good to have you back. So I watched James Comey's testimony today, and I found a bunch of surprises in there that I don't think the left-wing media shares, you know, my feeling that they're surprises. But when he talked to the president the very first time, he took notes because he thought that the president would lie to him. And there were a number of other things that surprised me about his testimony, but I wanted to get your take on it as well.
Well, that part is very, very troubling. You know, that what drove the director to that conclusion, I think we would like to hear some more. I certainly would, on what led him to that conclusion, that he was, you know, expecting that the president of the United States would lie to him. You know, I thought that the director's testimony, the manner in which he presented it, came off as very somber. I really don't think this is a place where Jim Comey ever thought he would end up, or a place that he would like to be. Certainly heard those comments early on about essentially apologizing to the FBI workforce that he was there today and in this situation, one that he did not really appreciate.
What did you think about the fact that back in May, not that long ago, a month ago, Comey had testified to the Congress that he never acted as an anonymous source for the media about the Russia probe or anything else, and he had also testified previously that he had never authorized anyone else to speak on his behalf. But after he was let go, he told the Congress today that he told the committee today that he had used an anonymous source or authorized somebody to, you know, leak a memo on his behalf to the New York Times.
You know, I am troubled, as I think many are, about leaks in government and leaks for a political purpose. I don't think there should be a place for them in government. You know, we do owe government workers owe a duty of loyalty to and certainly swear an oath to the Constitution of the United States. And so I think those politically driven leaks are very, very concerning. And in most cases, if it's sensitive information, if it's a classic leak that is sensitive or secret or top secret information, the government ought to vigorously try to find it, ferret it out, and prosecute those people involved. Here, I think you will find that Jim Comey's view was that what he was leaking about was something that he suspected was potentially a crime, and that crime might be obstruction of justice. And he is now leaving that in the hands of Bob Mueller to determine.
Although when he was asked about whether or not he was asked to obstruct justice, he said no. And here's the concern I have. You and I have talked before about classified info. Some of it is documents that have a marking on it that indicates it's classified. Some of it is just classified by its very nature. So James Comey has meetings with the president of the United States. He sits down and writes memos about what was said by both the president and himself. Would you think that that's the kind of thing that should be leaked out, and that conversations with the president, with a member of his administration, are the kinds of things that should not be leaked?
Yeah, generally speaking, that is the sort of thing that I think should not be leaked. That those private conversations, particularly when you're talking about potentially policy deliberations, those ought to be. And I know there's been a fair amount of discussion about executive privilege and when it can be invoked. And when it will be sustained by a court. Certainly, you know, I think the courts have found that if you're talking about conversations that amount to a crime or relate to a crime or certainly covering up a crime, I don't think courts in America are going to protect those as executive privilege. But I think broadly, I agree with you that these sorts of deliberative conversations and engagements are things that ought not to be leaked. The distinction here is potentially is it what Jim Comey perceived. Were they the steps that were the initial steps of a crime that were culminated actually in his termination?
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, Ron, and I'm talking to Ron Hosko from the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund, former assistant director of the FBI. When you were in the FBI, if I told you a lie and you were investigating a crime and I lied to you on some substantive matter, I've committed a crime by telling that lie, right?
Yeah, very frequently that's true. That's a statute. It's 18, titled 18 U.S. Code, section 1001. And I'll tell you that I was a strong proponent of us adding that count, false statements to an FBI agent, if your misstatements to me were on a material matter.
Yeah.
They weren't merely a false exculpatory. I was looking always in my cases with the U.S. Attorney's Office to append that to a case. Very often it wasn't the substantive count. It didn't stand alone. You wanted another crime committed in conjunction with it. But, you know, those false statements, whether it is to Congress, whether it's on a background investigation form, and the truth is, those are not always prosecuted. It depends on the context. But there were many of us, myself included, that were proponents of using that 1001 count, false statements, very strongly.
Well, and I am too. But let me ask you about this in terms of Flynn. I'm not the biggest fan of General Flynn, and he's now not in the Trump administration, you know. But at the time the FBI talked to him, they had a transcript of everything he had said to the Russian ambassador. So they go to talk to General Flynn. And they know exactly what he said and what the Russian ambassador said back. They had the whole conversation. And apparently, according to Comey today, their criminal investigation of Flynn is for, you know, crimes of statements. And Comey referred to that a few times today, saying this is a criminal investigation regarding his statements. So the FBI has a transcript of the entire conversation that he and the Russian ambassador had, and then they go and talk to him and say, did you talk about this? Did you talk about that? Did this subject come up? Did that subject come up? And then they match what he said to what they already know he said. And if the two don't match, then you're a criminal. Is that right?
Well, that sounds, the way you put it, Lars, very much like a trap.
Like, it does sound like a trap when there's no underlying crime.
Well, so the crime does become the false statement. And the question is, again, is it material? Are you merely giving the FBI false exculpatories? No, I don't recall it that way. And context is going to be important, because I think when Mike Flynn was making these calls as the
NSA
new incoming national security advisor,
That's
right. I think, I don't know the entirety of it, but I would assume that Mike Flynn was probably making a lot of calls to foreign government officials. And if that's true, and this is merely a memory failure, that's one thing. But if you're intentionally misleading me about the context of those calls, about the content of those calls,
right,
and you're doing that knowingly and intentionally, now you have a more serious problem.
Ron, thanks so much. We always appreciate your insights as a former director, a former deputy director of the FBI, and now with the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund. Thanks for the time. Ron Hoska with me. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.